He was at one time the youngest director with a feature film on Netflix. Writer and director Rob Smat is with me to talk about his film, The Last Whistle, and a soon-to-be-released documentary.
Welcome to the Ministry of Motion Pictures podcast,
where only the foolhardy and headstrong dare to venture.
For within these humble halls, you may find your heart stirred to join the ranks of a Christian film movement to storm the world with God-glorifying media. But be forewarned, this undertaking will lead you down a perilous road of hardship and scorn. And so, if you're committed to pursue this life of woe, brave soul, I now leave you to your resolute guide, writer and director, Todd Schaefer.
Writer and director Rob Smat made his feature film The Last Whistle when he was just 23 years old. It won a number of awards at some film festivals and was picked up by Netflix. The writing and directing in this film demonstrates a maturity of someone much older than 23. Though it's not intended to be a faith film, faith does play a role in this story. Rob is currently completing a documentary called Walkout, and it's making the rounds at the festivals this year. This USC grad is just at the beginning of his career, and it'll be very interesting to watch his career develop over the next decade. This is episode 60. Rob, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's great to have you.
Happy to be here. Glad we could finally make it work. It's funny to be doing, a Last Whistle podcast now two years after the film has come out, but always, a film's still out there. People are still watching it, enjoying it. Happy to finally make it work.
A good film never fades away. It finds new audiences, right?
That's right. That's right. There's always a next generation.
So I was introduced to your work through your feature film, which I think is a solid film. And it's a story about a high school football coach who pushes his team too hard. And one of the star players collapses from the punishment laps and dies. And it's a really interesting character piece, not just around the issue of coaches pushing their players too hard, but it also had a really nice story about the character himself, Victor, the coach, which I found very, very intriguing. It won Best Film at the Austin International Film Festival. It also won Deep in the Heart of Film Fest.
Right, it's the Australian Inspirational Film Festival. Yeah, our release didn't time up with Austin. And I don't think we were big enough to play any film festival bigger than the one that we debuted at, which is a great festival and one that I very much enjoyed premiering it. And may with my next movie, we'll see if it times up right.
Got it.
Yeah. And we played a few other film festivals, but we weren't in competition with them because we were like a showcase film or like a debut film or something. So those were our two awards, and one of them turned out to be a pretty cool trophy. And that's all that, film festival awards are great. If there's no cool trophy connected with them, the Waco one had a very cool trophy, and I love that one.
Oh, that's cool. And Netflix picked it up. Is it still running on Netflix?
The Netflix license ended this time last year. Mm-hmm. So now it's on AVOD. It's Pluto, Vudu. It is really easy to go and see the movie now in the United States. Internationally, it's starting to, our international team is finally starting to get that off the ground.
What was the inspiration behind this film?
It was more, it was a few things. The primary inspiration was there was a reality television show that was on the El Rey network called Rebel Without a Crew. Mm-hmm. And it was hosted by Robert Rodriguez, the director. And it was, based on his, groundbreaking book about making El Mariachi. And so I got the info on how to apply for that. And I was like, well, I don't have anything that fits a really, really low budget. So let me, pull together what I can. And that was where I thought, I've always wanted to do a movie about kids collapsing on the field. That's something that's always bothered me. I've always wanted to know more about that, bring awareness to it. And so that was the genesis of the idea, and kind of combining that with the budgetary restrictions and where I knew I could shoot around, Dallas, Fort Worth, where I was from. And yeah, that was the inspiration for it. And in the end, they didn't really gauge the submissions to the show based on what would make the best movie, who had the best resume. It was based on looks, and they said, we've got this many men, this many women, we've already cast the men, so we're not interested. And so that was what I was like, I said, all right, I'm gonna try to go do it myself.
So they tried to put something together and you just went somewhere else to do it?
Well, no, it was for like, do you know the show Project Greenlight?
Yes, I do, actually.
Okay. So it was Robert Rodriguez's like spinoff of Project Greenlight. Project Greenlight. They try to go make a movie for a couple hundred thousand, maybe $1 million. This was trying to redo the $7,000 production budget that he had for El Mariachi.
Okay.
Which is kind of silly because inflation adjustment, like none of it works out the same way. It's people trying to recreate El Mariachi are always going to fail now because it just doesn't. I mean, well, I say that and I just made my documentary for $7,000. So I guess I shouldn't. there I go. I'm already contradicting myself, but it was for a television show and it played one season and then they canceled it.
So how did you get it mounted on your side?
So it was, it's kind of using like speed was kind of the name of the game. I wanted to raise as much money as I could in as short amount of time as I could, just because, as you know, so many independent projects can just go on and on in terms of, oh, we just want to raise a little more. Oh, inflation's this much. Now we need to raise this much. And, oh, we want this bell and whistle, or we need this, so it's really, as we see in our federal government, it's really hard to stick to a budget whenever you can always go and get more money. Right. And so that was really the important thing to me is our budget is this, let's get that money. I know where I can get half of it. And I think I know where I can get the other half. And in the end, we had like 7 or 8 individual investors that were just, connections. They liked football. They wanted, I was shooting it where they were from and that they had interest in that. And so it took us about six months to raise the money or to get commitments for it before we felt comfortable.
Okay. So you not only wrote it and directed it, you were also heavily involved in the producing. And
heavily involved, not the only producer for sure. We definitely had great producers on it that have gone on to do great things. But we were all probably 21, 22 years old at the time. So that was the hard part, but it was also the part where I think it gives you a little bit of leeway. Being young and going back to what, going back to the book Jeremiah, or going back to, it's not the book of Jeremiah, but it's the story of Jeremiah. There's that weird, this sounds crazy, but maybe it could work. And in the end it did.
Yeah. Because before then you had done a lot of shorts.
Yeah. So I was in film school before then and just trying to sink my teeth into whatever I could.
Yeah. And this was your first real big project outside.
Yeah. At the end of high school, I had actually, filmed a feature, length project with like my friends, and I just wanted to see what it looks like in the timeline, and that ended up playing a real small film festival. So that was kind of a fun but no, you can't find that film anywhere. It's in the vault.
I think it was called Church Group or something like that.
That was a short. That was a short that I was pitching to be a feature.
Okay.
And I've still got that script, and I may return to it, but the landscape's changed a lot. I don't know if it has a place right now. I don't know if it says anything. I don't know if the church movie says enough about where we are right now and where the church is.
No, I understand. So do you think working on all those shorts all those years really prepared you for what you experienced on the film set?
Totally. And it's that was the funny thing was I took a directing class my senior year of college, and my teacher said, he said, for someone who looks so comfortable with actors and on set, you know very little about how to actually direct. And and it was a very, you know, it was sort of like the movie Whiplash, or, you know, you think of like a New York art school, like they're very tough, they're very direct. Mm-hmm. But I appreciated that. It was, you know, a backhanded, you know, constructive criticism.
Yeah.
And it was true, because I had spent so much time going and shooting films and watching other people do it and just seeing what's right and what's wrong. And by the end of the class, I had learned how to, you know, properly direct. But in terms of set demeanor, all of that, you know, it was really just, it wasn't so much what can I do right, it was what mistake can I discover. And that was right. Where, you know, I was shooting a short every month. If it was part of a class, if it wasn't, I just wanted to do it.
Yeah. Well, that's a great exercise to get out there and do those shorts. If that's what your goal is, I think have you been able to monetize any of those?
No, and I never expected to. The shorts have always been an avenue to features for me. I really, I don't watch a lot of shorts. I don't write a lot of shorts. They're really not my thing.
Yeah. I'm sort of ambivalent about the shorts, but, you know, I think when you're young, it does give you that experience where you're actually having to pull something together and then deliver it. That's invaluable.
I really like a short if it's a pitch for a feature.
Yeah.
But even that is starting to not, even, you know, even for the bigger scale stuff, they'd rather just have a book. You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, I think the only thing that I feel like that's really worked out with lately was like that drone video that, you know, went through that Chicago like bowling alley. Like, okay, you know, that's a short that will get you work, because it shows something new. It brings a fresh perspective to the medium.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to do that now because we are so postmodern.
Yeah, I think so. And that kind of thing, it'll get you a job maybe if you want to direct, but if you want to be a creator where you're writing and directing, that may not be the avenue to go.
Sure, because they've always got, you know, 100 other people that have gone and done the feature at this point, and you know, are first in line, and it's nuts. I think that's kind of been the hardest thing to discover ever since graduating which was 5 or 6 years ago, which is just, there's not a lot of people that are going to help you. Yeah. There are people that can help you at certain stages. And I think once you get to a certain point, there are a lot of people that can really help you, you know, and once you have the, you know, a little bit of acclaim and that sort of thing. But in between, there's just this, you know, valley of this arid valley where it's like you're just begging for mana as you like struggle through it.
No, yeah, that's for sure. So did Last Whistle, was that experience and then finally having that project done, did that give you any more credibility with your investors or with other producers?
Yeah, it did. And Last Whistle released June 2019, and then it went on to Netflix August 2019. And so it was sort of late 2019 when I was really trying to get out there and say, hey, here's what I did. I think, you know, I never officially figured it out, but one of my crew texted me and said, hey, I think you're the youngest director on Netflix right now. Like, who else, you know, because I was probably 23 or 24 at that point.
That's incredible.
Thanks. That's still something I carry with me. And that's sort of out of all the film festival awards, that's the one thing I'll keep on the bio, was briefly youngest director on Netflix. I don't know. Again, I never confirmed that, and I really should.
Yeah.
But there's really no way to I would say one of, not necessarily the. But anyway, so I was trying to kind of bring that around and say, hey, who's, but I think that really, it really timed up at the same time that, I kind of learned two things. One is that, you know, reps at that time were looking for a very specific kind of indie filmmaker to represent. Mm-hmm. And I didn't fit that mold. And at the same time, a lot of people in the industry just want to take what you've done, change it a little bit, and then go do it again. Yeah. And I didn't want to, given the opportunity I would have, and I did attach myself to a sports film that fell apart after, but I don't think there were a lot of sports films getting made at the time Last Whistle came out. And so no one was looking at the movie thinking, oh, I've got this other football movie that needs an indie director. It's just, just not how it works. And then, you know, third, I think that the, you know, I was hoping for, I wasn't really shooting for film festivals and industry success. I really wanted commercial success. I wanted to, you know, impress investors and have them come back and say, let's go do another movie. And that worked out with one of the investors, but then the people that, you know, it just COVID started pretty much.
Yeah. And COVID killed everything. Yeah.
So COVID killed everything. And, yeah, you know, it's like, I'm glad we got the movie out. I'm glad it wasn't marred by COVID and we got to watch the business model play out, but COVID was harmful.
Hmm. Were the investors able to make their money back on that?
We're still working on it. It's looking like it.
Oh, good. That's great. Yeah. I mean, COVID did a lot. It just soured everything. And then on top of it, you had the other layer of the industry just constantly in a flux of change and nobody really knowing what's going to happen. And then COVID and then threw everything and made it even more confusing.
And my biggest production of 2020 was getting married.
And oh, okay. There you go. That's another big one.
we were trying to get married in San Diego, which is, you know, kind of like Austin is to Texas, where it doesn't match the politics of the rest of the state to a T. Yeah. It's kind of its own thing. And so we're just witnessing local government and state government and federal government, just like this absolute, you know, cluster fudge of mistake of just like, oh my, you know, not even, I mean, in the end, the Supreme Court ruled that the state had acted in violation of the right to free religion. Mm. And so, you know, my wife and I are Catholic and we weren't able to get married inside of a Catholic church because of the violation of our constitutional rights, you know, right. But we were still able to perform the right under very specific circumstances and all that. But anyway, so that was 2020 for me. And I look back on, you know, 2020 and I'm like, man, I really didn't make any movies at that time. And it's like, well, it was a pandemic and I got married. So, but anyway, I was very, very familiar with all of California's and the industry's restrictions at that time because we were tracking them every day. They changed for our own nuptials.
Oh, that's incredible. So you're in California right now?
No, we're in Phoenix.
Oh, you're in Phoenix. Okay. All right. Good for you.
We've been all over the place since graduating, and my wife has got a lot of work that takes her around.
Back to The Last Whistle. I thought you had a great actor with Brad Leland doing Victor, the coach.
Awesome. Awesome actor. Awesome human being. Just a huge amount of fun. I wrote a couple more scripts trying to get Brad to star in them, and he's all for it. And they didn't really, we couldn't attach anybody else to him, but I hope I get to work with Brad again because he's awesome.
He's a good guy.
Couldn't have done it.
You also had Eric and Sainty Nelson. They've got long careers in acting and producing.
And they're just doing new stuff every day that just keeps getting. And I think that was kind of the fun thing was we had Eric and Sainty, especially. We had so many, you know, Brad's a veteran, but everybody else on the film, actors especially, very young, you know, really just not as young as me and the producers, but almost. And so many of them just such incredible talents that I hadn't gotten the opportunity to work with before. Even in film school, even having the acting school right next door to the film school, it's like the acting students aren't you know, they're great, but they don't you don't always get that next tier of caliber. And we got that with the actors on Last Whistle, and that influenced the creative aspect quite a bit.
Yeah. That's great. And you also gave a start to Brian Tang. I think he'd only done short films before.
I don't know if we were his first feature, but we were definitely his first, second or third. And he gave us a start as much as we gave him one. He was my friend from USC. And again, I hope to work with him again and pay him the big bucks because he's worth it.
Yeah. No, he did a great job on that.
It was funny working with him because and we had worked together before because I was kind of trying to gear him up to my style of production, which is very much whatever's in the frame is in the frame and everything else, you know, forget about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that a lot of you almost have the creativity that gets too involved when you're producing, and then you spend 2 or 3 hours trying to set up your first shot of the day and you're ruining the last 15 shots of the day because you spent two, and that's something I'm always mindful of. And he's great with that. I said, he'd be like, well, I need to set up another light for this shot. And I'd say, yeah, but then we're going to lose the last X number of shots if we spend this time setting up this light. I like what it looks like. It matches everything else we're doing. Let's just do it. And he would, say, okay, and I know that that's hard for a cinematographer, to say, this isn't to my degree of quality that I would like to have, but to trust, to have trust in the director as the, the director from a creative standpoint is the unifying factor. If you have a movie that really falls apart at certain points, it's because the director doesn't know how to keep, each shoot day and the quality of each shoot day to a specific standard. Right. And I think that's something that I wish I didn't have to. I wish I had let Brian have all the time and effort that he wanted to have. But I think he has. You know, I think he's gone to that big farm in the sky where he gets to spend infinite amount of time on everything. And I'm trying to go and join him now.
Wow, big farm in the sky.
Yeah, it's in. It's Culver City.
Okay. That big farm in the sky.
No, he's not dead. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. Okay. Wasn't sure what the
he is in heaven, but it is
Earth Culver now. City. How many shooting days did you have in this?
Okay. So that's the one thing is we shot it in 2018. And so I have to think back. I think it was 12.
12 days.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
That's pretty good.
13. It was 13 days. Yeah. And each day we only shot for 8 to 10 hours.
Okay. Wow.
So I know really? That people do 8-day shoots and they'll shoot for 16 hours a day, but I don't do that. I've always thought that hours, and I always thought that when overtime kicks in, you lose quality. And so I'd rather shoot for, I've been on TV shoots as like a background, just to fill in, and they'll shoot 16 and a half hours and it's, they've killed people doing that because they fall asleep on the drive home. I've always thought that's ludicrous. We shot 8 to 10 hour days for 13 days.
Well, that's great. That's quite fast.
Yeah. And it felt good. And there were definitely a couple of days where, we had a location just disappear on us in the first hour of the day. Ooh. And it's like, oh my gosh, we got it, and we'd worked so hard. I signed contract, not anything that was just a favor. But we had things that definitely threw us curveballs, and I always, when those scenes come up in the movie, I'm always like, we had been in there an hour earlier if they just opened that door for us, but that's the name of the game.
That's a shame. So what made you transition into documentary?
Necessity more than anything. I have this innate Christ-born creativity, as all of us do. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like a shark sometimes. If I'm not writing, if I'm not making a movie, I'm gonna be working at, Dairy Queen, which is not bad, which is not a bad career to have. but I either have to be moving at full speed or just, I got to call it a day. And so it was my, Thomas is my friend from USC as well. He was a film school minor, and I saw him doing all this stuff and being this crazy activist that was doing this crazy work and actually influencing like public policy and nobody was really paying attention to it. And I was like, I can go make a documentary about this guy. He'll sit down in front of the camera with me and maybe it'll just go straight onto Amazon Prime. But like, I just want to make another movie. I just want to, get this off the ground. And especially when that second sports movie fell apart, it was like the only movie I had left in development. I was like, let's do it. I gotta have a second movie.
Mm-hmm. So did you find that process easier or harder?
It was easier in different ways and harder in different ways. The producing is a lot easier because you're not working with 10 or 15 actors and 15 or 20 crew and scheduling and locations and line producing and things like that. It's harder because I didn't really come up, and I know critically, from a cinema studies perspective, a lot about documentary and writing for documentary. Mm-hmm. But in terms of clearances and the legal side of it, and that's definitely that's a part I'm not so familiar with. You know, I'm not as familiar with the composing and the music and the, you know, the editing side of it, I guess. Mm-hmm. So it's harder because I've almost gone, I went from what was already a low budget with Last Whistle, and I've cut that by a factor of 10 for a documentary now. And it's, you know, it's just, again, it's out of necessity, but, you know, we're applying for grants. We're going to try to get a grant to mm-hmm. kind of come in to help me out a little bit. But that was the funny thing with putting this documentary together, is it's like, okay, well, I'm going to shoot like a sizzle reel and then use that to apply. And I'm going to shoot this and use that to apply. And I kept shooting more and more that I was like, well, I just finished the movie. And, you know, so I guess I didn't need any of the grants up until now, but, you know, I still need them, obviously. So I'm continuing to send it out. But that's a rambling. That's the long story long answer.
So it might be easier to monetize and make your money back on that.
Yeah, it definitely a documentary is always going to be cheaper than a narrative.
Yeah.
But documentaries are a little riskier, you know, with a narrative, you definitely have a consistent audience that's going to buy tickets and show up for it. With a documentary, mm-hmm. you really have to have a niche audience that,
yeah.
And it can work out just the way. I think that's what they discovered probably 10 years ago now, is that, documentaries can actually be really successful in the marketplace, and mm-hmm. there's an audience for them.
Yeah.
That's the hope, but, you know, kind of learning what Last Whistle made and seeing how they marketed it. It's like, I think I could do a better job marketing a documentary. And even if the same size of an audience isn't there, taking those numbers and even cutting them by 10, it's like, oh, this would still be worthwhile. This would still be a good. And then of course, there's always a chance it could, you know, be huge and lots of people could watch it. And that's always what you're after. Mm.
So has this experience made you more interested in doing documentaries, or are you anxious to get back into narrative?
It has made me more interested in documentaries. Yeah. I really do enjoy. I think documentaries have a lot more room for, there's a lot more artistic bounds that haven't been pushed with documentaries that have already been pushed with narratives. And with documentaries, I think, there are too many people still doing it the very traditional way. And I think my the hardest part for me with a narrative film is if you have a shot that's missing something, if you have something that doesn't look right, you have to get rid of it. You have to can it, because the film has to maintain a very thin band of quality, mm-hmm. even if that thin band is like barely a C-, you know, passing. Yeah. It's like, but with a documentary, you're using whatever footage you can get a hold of, and right. you're like, there's, you know what, like, you know, there's got to be 60 to 90 seconds of my own film that's probably like 600 by like VGA, you know, quality, and it's nuts. But it's a documentary, and as long as the story, you know, it's the commitment to story that makes me like documentary. As long as the story is there, mm-hmm. the movie can have some real gaps in how good the footage is. And that's what I like about it, is the freedom and the cheapness. If somebody comes to me and says, hey, I've got, you know, $20,000, I want to make a documentary about this musician, it's like, cool, I can actually do that.
That's really interesting. So tell me a little bit about your documentary.
So the documentary is called Walk Out. Like I said, it's a friend of mine from college. He was working at Walmart's e-commerce corporate office in the Bay Area whenever the mass shooting happened in their El Paso store in 2019.
Yeah.
And he basically just blasted out an email to all their like 20,000 corporate employees saying, you know, taking violent video games off the shelves isn't the answer. I want, you know, me and a number of other employees want actionable policy change within Walmart to address, you know, what's happening. And continues to happen, obviously, as we just saw in Uvalde and Buffalo. And it's just kind of like that rash of gun violence. And so I wanted to make this movie because I grew up around guns and I like sports shooting. And I thought I could bring a really interesting bipartisan moderate approach to the film, mm-hmm. and not necessarily preach to the choir with it, but make something that, you know, that I think the message at the end of the, you know, he basically goes through this period of activism, and spoiler alert, in the end, Walmart takes assault rifle ammo, handguns. They take them off the shelves. If you walk into a Walmart today, their sportsman firearms section, it's mostly empty. Because they just, you know, they haven't put anything back there. It's still just kind of a, you know, maybe they're thinking about bringing them all back someday, but for now it's the guns are not on the shelves at Walmart. And it's kind of nice because, and I think that's what I like about it as someone that's kind of in the middle politically is, why was Walmart selling assault rifle ammo? It's Walmart. Mm-hmm. They want to have a Walmart in every, they want Walmarts to be as ubiquitous as like Starbucks is.
Right.
And it's like, I don't want Starbucks to start selling stuff that can kill people. And in that same way, I think Walmart has grown to the size that they can't. And they're even starting to do this with tobacco and e-cigarettes. They're this size where they can't sell everything that they might want to because it almost endorses it. And so that's kind of the message at the center of the film is employee activism, gun reform, and activism that doesn't rely on politicians.
Right. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a new. I just think it's really, yeah, exactly. That's the kernel of it. It's just interesting. Like it's just an activism story that I hadn't seen told before.
And where will it be released?
I don't know yet. We're out to film festivals. I know you recommended a couple of Christian ones. I don't think the Christian folk festivals
would play. Yeah, no.
But we're, you know, the reach festivals right now are Toronto and Telluride. The middle tier ones are Hot Springs, Camden, Austin Film Fest. And then the ones that I'm really hoping we'll be able to get into are like Lone Star, Dallas Film Festival, mm-hmm. El Paso Film Festival. Mm-hmm. The really hyper-regional ones that I know will appreciate it and give us, you know, lots of trophies. And so anyway, my hope for distribution, obviously the easiest way is an all rights deal. Would be amazing. I don't know if it's to that quality. If it gets into a higher tier festival, then I'm probably gonna, you know, maybe even just find money somewhere to keep working on the composition and the color correction and things like that. But my hope is it'll be available everywhere. And if I have to self-distribute it, you know, I'm entirely prepared to do that as long as I've got money to cover the legal side of things and make sure that I'm in good standing.
Rob, you're so young. You've got your whole career ahead of you still, and you've already done a couple features and a documentary.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for taking the time.
Keep us posted. It'll be nice seeing how your career develops.
Yeah, I just wrote a script that I sent in to Pure Flix, and they rejected it. But I, you know, I'm desperately trying to get my biblical dramas produced somewhere. They're there. It's just I don't know. No market for them yet.
It's a hard nut to crack.
It is.
Stay persistent, and it'll come through.
That's right. It's the name of the game.
Terrific, Rob. I thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing your story with us. Keep in touch.
You'll find links to where you can watch The Last Whistle in the show notes of this episode.
Our time together draws to a close, valiant filmmaker. We trust your heart has been warmed and your soul nourished. Your host has been Todd Schaefer, creative director of the faith-based independent production house Glorious Films and animation director at Tonic DNA, where he toils on productions for the major Hollywood establishment. If you wish to support the work of the ministry or simply buy your overworked host a fancy $5 coffee to keep him warm and caffeinated as he pecks out his next script, you can do so on our website at ministryofmotionpictures.org. Again, that's ministryofmotionpictures.org. And you can help spread the word by feeding the algorithms when you share, like, link, follow, subscribe, or leave a nasty comment on our social media. Until we see you again, I adjure you, in the name of our Lord, go forth and boldly create film.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.